Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School, and welcome back to another section of Computer Consult. In this session, we try to update and provide clinical guidance and practical information regarding a fairly common topic or evolving topic of interest. In today's discussion, I thought we would talk about eosinophilic esophagitis. Boy, it's certainly been an explosive area of literature in regard to clinical reports and controversies about how do you make the diagnosis, what do you do when you establish the diagnosis, what's the natural history. And to that means, I thought we could use today a backdrop of most recently published guidelines from the American College of Gastroenterology on this condition. Now, there have been two previous consensus guideline statements, not published by the ACG, but in 2007 and 2011, and this is the first foray into the guideline recommendation for EOE, or eosinophilic esophagitis, made by the American College of Gastroenterology. It starts with a very complex problem because we do have such heterogeneity in definitions, in endpoints, and resolving this was recognized by the committee. And when they tried to grade their recommendations, there were very few, when they used the grade system, that they could come across with strong recommendations and high level of evidence. So there are very few strong recommendations, and none of which have high level of evidence. So again, put this in perspective when you take these discussions today. I thought it'd be helpful to provide a little bit of a synthesis for you about what was discussed in that guideline and give you a backdrop of things that may have been different since the last time you had a discussion or thought about this. Well, certainly the diagnosis is not an uncommon one. We didn't see this two decades ago, but we've seen this with increasing recognition. And the diagnosis is typified by, in adults, food impaction. 34 to 50% of patients with EOE present with a food impaction. In children, it's more typical in the less than 1 year to present with failure to thrive. And in the younger children, it's more typical to present with abdominal pain or vomiting. So these are conditions that vary based on presentation simply by age. The diagnosis has been really the cardinal principle of an endoscopic diagnosis, but histologic confirmation. And the number of eosinophils per high power field is typified by at least 15 eosinophils per high power field. But the catch is there are other things that cause eosinophils in the esophagus besides eosinophilic esophagitis. And in fact, the recognition of this is important when you start to apply the diagnosis. So, what else causes esophageal eosinophilia? Well, things like pemphigus, Crohn's disease, a variety of autoimmune diseases, things that can be hypereosinophilic syndrome, allergic reactions, vasculitis, drug-induced medication reactions, a variety of things, achalasia we've even seen cause this, and these things all need to be considered in regard to the definition and start to find what eosinophilic esophageal inflammation really means when you start to make it this diagnosis. Now, the diagnosis is really an important thing. Once you establish the biopsy diagnosis, if eosinophils in the esophagus, how many biopsies do you need to do? Well, the consensus is that you need to do a minimum of four, and you need to do this in two separate areas at least, and the recommendation is to separate it. So proximal and distal, at least four biopsies, and the reason to separate this is to exclude things like gastroesophageal reflux disease, things that may otherwise have very variable presentations and again may not be, if you lumped all the biopsies together, you may be misled. We do know that eosinophils in the esophagus are variable in their presentation when you do these biopsies. So I said a minimum of four biopsies, but if you do 6 to 9 biopsies, it's virtually 100% will capture at least the sensitivity for detecting eosinophilic esophagitis. It's important to recognize the biopsies should be done regardless of the endoscopic appearance. And where it is that we can typify an endoscopic appearance with the corrugated rings, or there are certain suggestive features, and I'll go into this in a second. But nonetheless, about 20% of these patients, when they present with adults, have normal endoscopic exams. So do the biopsies if you're thinking that this is important to exclude in patients with dysphagia or patients with chest pain. It's important in children, in all children, to make biopsies of the stomach and of the duodenum. In particular, look for hypereosinophilic syndrome or eosinophilic gastroenteritis. In adults, if there's any endoscopic aberration there, or you think about something with abdominal or gastric or intestinal symptoms, then the biopsy should be done from those areas as well. Now, with the biopsies made, what do you really do as far as your next step? Well, the next step would be, what do you treat these people with? Well, one of the things that's really become very clear is that a lot of these patients have PPI, proton pump inhibitor, responsive eosinophils in the esophagus. And it's very important to understand that this categorization of EoE, eosinophilic esophagitis, should not be rushed without a trial of proton pump inhibitor therapy. So we've recognized that PPIs make EoE or like EoE type presentation better. Clearly, there's a subset of patients just with gastroesophageal reflux disease that have eosinophils in their esophagus as well. If you go back and look at the original descriptions by Ismail Baghi back in the 1970s as regard to histologic findings for gastroesophageal reflux disease, eosinophils in the esophagus were a classic part of that description. So now let's move into the proton pump responsive eosinophilic or esophageal eosinophilia. What does that mean? Well, those patients should be put on a PPI therapy for a minimum of 8 weeks and then reassessed either endoscopically or histologic with histologic confirmation. Or if you're going to follow these people symptomatically, again, that could be done. The recommendation typically is to reassess them histologically because symptoms may be somewhat misleading. Patients may modify what they're doing in their diet or their reporting bias may be misled. And if you're not categoric on this, you may again be dealing with untreated or partially treated eosinophilic esophagitis. So the recommendation is to put these people on typically at least once a day, and most experts would say twice a day therapy, between 20 and 40 milligrams of the standard PPIs. In the extended PPIs, such as dexlansoprazole, perhaps that could be done certainly as once a day therapy. But an extended treatment for at least 8 weeks, much like you would do for erosive esophagitis. Now, with that being said, what do you do if the patients are not better with PPIs? Well, then you're moving into the EoE type category, and what else can you use to establish the diagnosis? Well, the endoscopic features are really something that now have been validated. We talk about a description that classically see corrugated rings or linear furrows. There is now a validation scheme that again is cited by the American College Guidelines Committee, where they cite a very nice description and a validated instrument developed by Hirano and colleagues published earlier this year in Gut. And basically what they do is they look at a variety of endoscopic features. One that you may not be as familiar with is the mucosal pallor. And this is loss of vascularity or edema, appearing a type mucosa. And this is graded, again, all these criteria, endoscopic criteria, are graded by major and minor criteria. So the major ones are this endoscopic perception of edema. There's certainly the validation of linear furrows or exudates, the strictures that are seen as it relates to concentric rings, a variety of things with mucosal plaques. These are all major criteria, and the minor criteria they used was the crepe paper type friability. As you pass the endoscope, you may see that the mucosa becomes very easily disrupted or very friable. And again, the long strictures that sometimes are seen very less common in eosinophilic esophagitis. These again are some of the instruments now validated by Hirano and colleagues as far as endoscopic features. Don't forget, biopsy, even if you don't see these things, but again, it's something histologically that you confirm regardless. Now, if you found that the patient is not better with PPIs, what should you do? Well, the data is quite strong that the standard therapies as it relates to steroids work very well. The typical approach would be to use a swallowed steroid, such as fluticasone, in kids beginning at 88 to 440 micrograms in split doses, and the adult would be somewhere in the 880 to 1760 micrograms daily, again in split doses. Or budesonide can be used as well. Budesonide in 1 milligram for kids and for 2 milligrams again in split doses for adults. A slurried form of budesonide has been studied and shown to be quite effective as well. Systemic steroids are helpful, but certainly not something that we try and use, but in the refractory case, that certainly could be used. There's no data that suggests that the topical inhaled or topical swallowed steroid approach is something that leads to adrenal suppression, but again, this has not been well studied. There is one study that's looked at maintenance form of therapy with this, and again, shown some variable but statistically significant improvement in maintenance therapy with the swallowed budesonide, but again, only one study and very limited data to support that at present. So when you do this endoscopic reassessment, again, the biopsy target should be resolution of the eosinophilic esophageal inflammation for less than 15. Some studies have required less than 90% reduction, but again, the endpoints here are not absolute certainly less than 15 eosinophils per high power field is certainly one that most studies would accept as a reasonable endpoint. Now, if they don't respond to this, what else can you do? Well, the guidelines suggested the diet approach, which I think is a very pragmatic one. We get an allergist involved in all of our patients and have them either patch test or skin prick test. About 13% of these will demonstrate something that's helpful that they can be selectively withdrawn. If not, there are a variety of things easily done, but not so typically easily done in adults, more so in kids, where these things can be withdrawn in a very controlled way. But elemental diets have been used. That I don't think is very pragmatic. It's not very palatable. They have to be administered by a nasolenteral tube. But selective withdrawal diets have been very helpful. And again, this has been studied more in children, but again, data is evident in the adults as well. What do I mean by selective withdrawal? Well, these are things, the typical food allergies that you see are wheat, soy, milk. There are nuts, and also as it relates to seafood, these are things that typically are withdrawn in either a global fashion and then reintroduced, generally at 4 to 6 weeks, reintroduction of these food groups. And again, these are things that can be reintroduced one at a time. Their guidelines suggested that recommendation was reintroduce two of them and then re-biopsy. So again, looking at eggs, wheat, milks, soy, seafood, and nuts. Most of the patients, if you're going to pick one, is going to be either wheat, which is about 60% of the patients are sensitive to wheat, and about 50% to milk. Those are the top two. So if you're going to look for the more bang for your buck, those are the two that I would really target. Now, you can reintroduce and re-biopsy, or you can follow them symptomatically. If you're going to be really pragmatic about this, re-biopsy after two food groups, and again, looking for symptom exacerbation or endoscopic evidence of exacerbation. That's something that's reasonable. And again, virtually everybody relapses when you take all these things away. So whether you can get to a reasonable basis of controlled diet is really the target. Again, working with a dietitian sometimes is much more helpful here. What about the endoscopic evaluation? We talked about the diagnosis. What do you do endoscopically for therapy? Well, on initial diagnosis, when these patients present with food impaction, it's probably reasonable to go ahead and dilate them. Hydrostatic balloons are probably my choice because of the recommendation that these things have linear type of tear forces if you use an axial dilator such as a Bougie or a Savory dilator. This is something that is less likely to happen with an endoscopic or radial type symmetric dilator. Again, the data on this is quite scant to say one's better than the other, but that seemed to be the preference also from the guidelines committee. It's reasonable to start and go carefully because these things are quite fragile when you do start to do endoscopic dilation, have low determinant endpoints, and again, if you're endoscopically dilating with one of these hydrostatic balloon dilators, you can assess the mucosa in between dilations, and when you have mucosal disruption, that's your endpoint. That's when you should stop and come back another day following these patients symptomatically. I think it's important in my practice to educate these people how to swallow and chew, cutting things into small pieces, but pragmatically avoiding things like tough meat, doughy bread products, things with skins on them, raw vegetables. Again, pasta sometimes will be very attributable to food impaction in these people. So again, re-edifying what they should be eating. And again, most of these people can acclimatize their diet and go forward. You should warn these patients that chest pain is almost invariable after a dilation. The guidelines recognize it's up to about 75%, so it's not an infrequent. And again, putting these people on alert, again, you want to make sure that you haven't perforated them, but there really doesn't seem to be an incremental risk for perforation in this population, provided you're following appropriate guideline recommendations for dilation. How about maintenance therapy? Well, the natural history, I think, is the backdrop, and virtually none of these people resolves and goes away. They turn to live with it, and again, following these people sequentially, there have been no reports of people going on to develop hypereosinophilic syndrome or eosinophilic gastroenteritis, so that's good. I think it's reasonable to consider maintenance therapy in some patients if they have a rapid relapse. If there is a recommendation that might really drive you is somebody like a Boerhaave's that got a food impaction and perforated their esophagus, you know that their likelihood for redeveloping a bolus obstruction is not that low. And again, if patients have a predisposition to rapid relapse and they prefer to be on something, this is a reasonable thing to view as maintenance therapy. Be aware that if you're using some of these topical swallowed steroids, there is a risk for esophageal and pharyngeal candida. About a third of these patients will develop esophageal candidiasis. If you're not careful when you swallow this fluticasone or budesonide, you have to tell them not to swallow food or water for 30 minutes. But when they do swallow, they should rinse their mouth out very well to make sure they don't have pharyngeal candidiasis. And again, it's not inconsequential, but these patients clearly, because they're using steroids, can develop candida. So the bottom line is we have a lot of I think, better evidence for consensus, not absolute evidence, and certainly the recommendations and guidance for what to do in practice have been improved by the current ACG guidelines, but the answers are not all in yet. So hopefully this has given you a little bit of strategy that you can better edify yourself to deal with the next patient you see with eosinophilic esophagitis. It's Dr. David Johnson. I look forward to chatting with you again soon. Thanks again for listening.